Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call the Transportation Policy and Transit Committee to order today. And we have a number of bills, so we'll try to get started quickly. Before I do that, I just wanted to give a special shout out to the ninth graders at St. Louis Park High School that are with us today. But we do want you to be aware that we're in a legislative hearing, so I think your teacher mentioned the protocol there in terms of quiet. So a couple of quick announcements for members. I wish we had more people here, but well, you know what? I think I'll wait till more members are here before I give you the pretty busy schedule for this committee over the next week. So we have a couple of bills by Representative Mariani first, and it's always fun to have him here. So Representative Mariani, welcome, a warm welcome to the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And many years ago, perhaps even before these young people were born, I served on this committee in the 90s.
Oh, good. So that's why he knows so much about transportation.
Well,
you know, I will...
Me up here.
I'll move that your House File 988 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy Committee. Members, there's no fiscal note needed for this bill, so I think it's going to just travel the policy route to the House floor. So welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and also hello to the ninth graders. I chair the K-12 Education Policy Committee at 8:30 in the morning, so you guys show up at 8:30 in the morning and we'll give you a nice welcome there. Mr. Chair, members, some of you are familiar with the real ID issues, but I know we've got a couple of new members on the committee. The bill is really quite simple in terms of what it does. It basically just prevents Minnesota through the Department of Public Safety from taking any steps to implement or plan for implementation of the Federal Real ID Act of 2005. This was the subject of extensive floor discussion in both bodies over the course of the last couple of years. We actually passed this twice, or something very similar to this, on the House floor, I believe also on the, yeah, on the Senate floor as well. Both of those instances were subsequently vetoed by the governor. But the issue remains, members. And let me just give you a very, very quick run through, just to let you know that, you know, the author has some competency related to this issue, and then I'll have my testifiers explain more in detail. The Real ID Act in 2005 was passed ostensibly to provide greater protection for the United States, but is really, quite frankly, in my opinion, and an opinion of an incredible diversity of individuals across an incredible ideological spectrum, is seriously flawed. The Real ID Act of 2005 creates national standards for the issuance of state driver's license and ID cards. I don't need to tell this committee that that has historically, traditionally been the purview and the right and the discretion of states to determine those standards. It would de facto create a national ID card. And also a massive, and this is what makes it a national ID card, a massive national database within which all sorts of information will be stored. It imposes federal technology standards and verification procedures on all state driver's licenses. It would prescribe what our state's licenses and IDs should look like, what kind of information would be collected, verified, how that information is stored, how it's read, and other potential mandates that the federal government at any point can choose to add to once we are fully engaged in Real ID. So in other words, we would be handing over to legislators in Washington, D.C. to make important decisions relative to our data privacy issues that arise in terms of collecting information on our driver's license. There are cost issues. I'm not going to run through the estimates because I have dated estimates from last year, but I think my testifiers will talk about a little bit about cost. It's my belief that we're essentially talking about the large unfunded mandate from the federal government. There are obviously privacy issues, as I alluded to, in terms of the information that gets stored on this national database, which again can be continually adjusted in attitude by action on the part of Washington, D.C. There are security issues that arise, just sort of commonsensically, members, when you create one single big database. It really raises the stakes in terms of security issues, because then you only really basically need one way to get in, and in order to get all sorts of information that may be collected. There are serious, there are process questions here in terms of implementation that we believe would require more staff, more training, more storage, more verification, and frankly a larger bureaucracy in order to deal with it, and ergo the unfunded cost measures. Members, Minnesota's driver's license is recognized by industry standards as being a strong, safe driver's license in terms of fraud that can be committed trying to access it. There are other states that have taken action in regards, but I mentioned the actions that we took as a legislative body, but my understanding is, as of this date, there are 20 states that have taken some form of formal action, either greatly limiting implementation and participation in Real ID, or just flat out saying no to it. 11 states have passed statutes in regards to this provision. 9 states have passed resolutions. Remember, this is not a partisan issue. This is one of those fun areas where people on the left like me and people on the right like, let me find someone on the right here.
No one on the right in this committee.
We have a few, huh? where we meet. And frankly, I think we meet on this issue because of very strong civil libertarian tendencies and streaks and values that are part of, frankly, in my opinion, part of what constitutes being an American citizen. And ergo, you know, the bipartisan vote that we had last year relative to passing a prohibition. So members, that's the background. Mr. Chair, I would ask my testifiers to fill you in more, and then we'll take it from there.
So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Charles Samuelson, and I'm the Executive Director of the ACLU of Minnesota. The ACLU of Minnesota is the Minnesota affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union with approximately 11,000 members statewide. The ACLU of Minnesota represents the United States and Minnesota Constitution, including the rights of due process, equal protection of the law, and privacy. We are here to testify in favor of House File 988, which rejects the Federal Real ID Act. The Federal Real ID Act imposes substantial burdens on Minnesota and its citizens. These burdens come in the form of enormous costs that are inadequately funded by the federal government, which makes this a huge unfunded mandate for Minnesota, a massive invasion of citizens' privacy, significant additional work for the Minnesota Department of Vehicle Services, and significant civil liberties violations. The federal government passed the Real ID Act in 2005 without debate or hearing as part of the Indonesian tsunami relief bill. On January 11, 2008, the Department of Homeland Security issued its final regulation for implementing the Real ID Act. On May 17, 2008, Governor Pawlenty signed an executive order postponing implementation of the Real ID Act in Minnesota until this June 1st. There was no funding for Real ID in the federal stimulus package, and there is no current plan in Congress to further fund Real ID. The last money available to Minnesota was a grant for $694,000, which the state received in 2008. The projected costs, by the way, for Real ID are a $12 million implementation cost and ongoing cost of $19 million. According to the Department of Vehicle Services testimony, receipt of this grant does not legally obligate Minnesota to comply with Real ID. Given our current fiscal crisis, Minnesota is not in a position to accept financial responsibility for a massive unfunded mandate. Privacy. because we do not know what the infrastructure of the data sharing mandated by Real ID will look like. There is no way to know how the privacy of Minnesotans' personal information will be safeguarded. Department of Homeland Security regulations contain no national security plan for Americans' personal information. Instead, they assume the states will figure it out. Further, the Department of Homeland Security contemplates that the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators will operate the database. This private association is accountable neither to Minnesota voters nor to the American public in general. It is not bound by either the Federal Privacy Act, which applies to federal agencies, or the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, which applies to state motor vehicle agencies, or to the Minnesota Data Practices Act. Excess state requirements. Under current federal law, the Minnesota Department of Vehicle Services will be forced to reprocess existing licenses. The federal regulations acknowledge that all applicants will need to complete, quote, an application process similar to those of a first-time driver, unquote. This means that DVS will have to revamp how applications for new licenses and renewals are handled. Many of Real ID's mandates, such as presenting source documents, verifying identity, and taking a digital photo, will require an in-person application. Minnesotans will be forced to wait in long lines to renew their unexpired driver's license. DVS offices could also be overwhelmed by the need to develop and maintain significant new document storage and retention capacity. This will require additional staff, new equipment, and computer software, and the remodeling and redesigning of driver's license stations. The regulations will also require extensive new training in detection of fraudulent documents. Real ID regulations impose on states the increased cost and burden of this training without providing any funding to pay for it. Constitutional problems with the Act. The Real ID Act violates the Constitution in a number of ways. It burns Americans' right to travel, which has been recognized as a right by the U.S. Supreme Court under the First Amendment. In addition, because a Real ID will be required to enter a federal building, including a courthouse, there are significant implications for Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment due process. The Sixth Amendment right to trial before a jury of one's peer, and the First Amendment right to petition government officials. Real ID also requires, without any exemption, that a digital photograph appear on each identification card. This requirement violates the First Amendment-protected religious beliefs of several religious groups, including the Amish, Mennonites, Muslim women, and conservative Christian sects, impacting their free exercise of religion. The department's regulations affirm that in order to receive a Real ID, every applicant must have a photo taken. While the regulations acknowledge religious objections, they do not offer a real solution to this constitutional problem. Instead, they assert that states can provide religious objectors with non-Real ID compliant licenses, which will restrict their right to travel, their ability to access federal offices, and violating Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment equal protection rights. No Minnesota citizen should be forced to choose between his or her religious beliefs and the need to use an ID card to freely move about the country, enter a federal office, and operate in society in a myriad of other ways. Real ID cannot really be fixed. That is why 11 states, Georgia, Maine, Montana, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Washington, Alaska, Arizona, Idaho, and Louisiana have enacted statutes opting out of the program. 9 additional states, Arkansas, Colorado, Hawaii, Illinois, Nebraska, Nevada, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Tennessee, have passed resolutions to opt out or demand that Congress repeal Real ID. It is time for Minnesota to demand to be released from this deeply flawed federal mandate. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Samuelson. Are there any questions for the testifier or author at this point? Thank you. Is there anyone else in the among the public with us today that would like to testify either in favor or opposed to this legislation? Yes, McCormick. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. And the department isn't here to take a position on this legislation. My only request was to at least keep you up to date in terms of the fact that Driver and Vehicle Services is not working towards compliance of the Real ID Act as specified in the governor's executive order, and also to let you know, though, that as a member of the American Motor Vehicle Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, we are kept up to date in terms of what's being considered, and just to let the committee know that right now there are several proposals that are being discussed at the federal level regarding changes to the Real ID Act. And one of the main issues that is of concern is the fact that according to the regulations that were passed, the all the states would be required in order to board an airline by January 1st of 2010 to have a Real ID compliant driver's license or identification card unless they have a passport. And so there's much urgency on the part of many jurisdictions, as was pointed out, in terms of finding some way to change the current law, and there are various discussions going on. One would be for sure that I have heard discussion from several sources is to eliminate that part of the regulation that would say that in order to board an aircraft you would have to have a Real ID compliant driver's license or ID card. And so that is something that is under discussion, and as well I'm sure many of you have heard various officials that are with the Department of Homeland Security say that they believe that the law does need to be changed in order to address the fact that it is an unfunded federal mandate. And so those issues are under discussion. We have received a grant this year. It was applied for well before the governor's executive order. That funding we are using it for is to work on fraud issues related to the driver's license. And so we have been getting ready to use that funding for that purpose, but it is not a purpose that's really related to Real ID. It's related to enhanced security, and that's what the grants are that they are offering now to states are to enhance driver's license security. They have nothing to do with Real ID. And so all I wanted to do was just provide some information to the committee, because I know this has been an issue of concern for all the members.
Thank you very much, Representative Mariani. Thank you, Ms. McCormick, very much.
Mr. Chair and members, I just want to make sure, and I appreciate the testimony from the department today, but I want to make sure that we're not leaving any impression here that, particularly on this issue of boarding planes, that there would be then no requirements for identification. The issue here goes to whether or not it's a Real ID mechanism that serves as the identification piece. It is not this office's intention, nor this legislature's intention over the course of the last year to do anything that would compromise our safety. The issues here really go to the issues of civil liberties, they go to the issues of cost, they go to those two primary. Frankly, they also go to the issues of rights reserved to the states. I think as a legislator, I'm always particularly mindful of the incredible ability and power and coercive presence of the federal government at times relative to work that we are charged through our elections to responsibly carry out, and sometimes those abilities are taken away by, in my opinion, over excessive federal action.
Yeah. I have, thank you, I have Representative Holberg, Davids, and Erdahl. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. McCormick, we've spent a lot of time around this issue and the fact that the legislature enacted a fee on licenses in order to fund a new computer system for driver's licenses, and one of my concerns around this issue is that we not impede the department's ability to get a state-of-the-art computer system that may in fact have capabilities similar to what's required in Real ID, but not for necessarily the purposes of implementing Real ID. Could you, for the record, speak to that issue and whether or not you view this legislation as in any way impairing your ability to design and put out an RFP and purchase a state-of-the-art computer system for the state's driver's license program?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, unless there is some directive that would eliminate our ability to enhance the security of the driver's license and ensure that data privacy would be protected, but that we could electronically, we need to be able to electronically communicate with other driver's license systems. And so unless, if there was some a limitation which would not allow us to do that, then that would be my fear, that we wouldn't be able to continue with the redesign of our system. And I'll speak specifically to federal law that relates to commercial driver's licenses, which does require, with an encrypted system that can electronically verify through a pointer system. It doesn't send the information to another state, but it points to another state that then we receive information so that we are sure that a driver has only one driving record and it does not have driving records in other states. And if we don't have the ability to do that, then we would be sanctioned by the federal government and probably not allowed to issue commercial driver's licenses because of the fact that you need to ensure the law was written, and it was through Congressman Oberstar that wrote that law, that you have one driver, one record, and all states have to meet that responsibility. And so the concern would be that, and I don't see that as being the only law that's out there, so if the law directly just deals with specific requirements in the Real ID Act, I don't see it as being a problem. But if it's expansive, it could be a problem because we do have to have the ability to electronically communicate with other systems in order to do our job.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick.
Representative Holberg, follow-up.
Yeah, well, this is for Chair Mariani, and I apologize if I missed this. Given the civil issues around this, are you going to the Civil Law Committee, or?
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Holbrook, I believe that is our motion.
Well, it's public safety at this point, public safety policy, and I guess it will be up to that chair to see where we go from there.
Possibly move to. So I can tell you, obviously we're pushing deadlines here, but I know that 2 years ago when we moved the original provision, you and I spoke on the floor because we had moved it straight to the floor, and I think you raised this issue with me, and I was more than willing to make sure that it's coming back to have that kind of vetting. I can't remember whether, I know we pulled it off before we sent it back to the committee. I can't remember if we sent it
Mr. Chair, I'm not so sure. I mean, I can see why there might be a crime component to this, but if you had to pick between crime or civil, just my opinion, this is much more a civil law kind of issue than a crime committee issue. So I don't know. Maybe you'll have to do a transfer on the floor or something if, in fact, you go to the Hilton's committee.
Well, Representative Holberg, this was actually specifically requested by public safety. So, you know, which happens sometimes, but, you know, at this point, I think it would be, you know, perhaps up to the author and the chairs of the Civil Law and Public Safety Committees to have a conversation, but I hope that that can be resolved and we can deal with it.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of the committee time, I won't go into the civil law kind of components of it, but I would expect that the bill would go to that committee.
Okay. Well, I think it's important if there's a member that feels that way that we, you know, accommodate the process as best we can. I'm going to take Representative Davis, Representative Riddle, and then we're going to need to vote members. We've got three more bills. They're pretty involved, so I want to make sure that we have proper discussion but also move along. So, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to either the author, Ms. McCormick. couple of questions here. First of all, if this bill did not pass and we did nothing, would we then be by de facto signing up for Real ID, or do we have to take some action to do it or not to do it?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, the issue would be that our residents would not be able to board a commercial airline without having a Real ID compliant driver's license or ID card or a U.S. passport. They'd have to have similar identification, as was stated earlier, to enter federal buildings, not ports, but federal buildings, and they would have to wouldn't be able to enter nuclear power plants without having it. Those are the three main areas where you need to have a Real ID compliant driver's license or ID card or passport would be the only documentation allowed for entry after starting January 1st, 2010. So, according to what the current law is right now.
Representative Davis.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chairman, if we do nothing and we don't enact the Real ID, or if we go with Representative Mariani's bill and we say we're not going to do this, then, for example, when I fly down to Mason City to make my annual pilgrimage to Clear Lake for Buddy Holidays, I need a passport?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, that would be correct, unless there's other legislation that's passed at the federal level.
Mr. Chair, the salt for the issue of coercion on the part of the federal government, and it speaks to the issue of rights reserved to the state. I don't know the nature of the statutes that have been passed in 11 other states. Quite frankly, it is my, and obviously, it's just my opinion, but it's my opinion that a strong message needs to be sent back to the federal government that that our state, because of the importance of a number of issues, including a civil liberties issue, are going to draw a line in the sand on this issue. And I believe that's what other states have done, although I can't speak specifically for all of them. My understanding, obviously, we have a different administration both in Congress and in the White House. And my understanding is that they're looking for, I won't editorialize, they're looking for messages from states relative to the original framework. But Ms. McCormick is absolutely technically correct. That would be the under law, what would be the consequence.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm so long, and I'd request that nobody ask for roll call because I don't want it on the record that I support the ACLU. But,
roll call having been, no. Representative Rudolph for the last word on this from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mariani, first of all, I want to commend you on your new limited government approach, and I understand that this July 1st, 2010 is when this goes into effect. Is that correct? Either of you?
Mr. Chair and Ms.
McCormick.
Erdahl, it's January 1st, 2010.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
And understand the... let's just say then that we didn't do this, that I flew to a state that has it. And I wanted to leave that state.
State one should leave.
I mean, is there a problem here?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, so you mean you fly and you're...
We don't have it. I say fly to a state that does. How do I leave?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, you may need to rent a car.
Or apply for a passport.
Okay. Continue, Mr. Chairman. Did I understand the cost is about $12 million? Is that the cost? Or am I wrong?
Mr. Chair, remember, that's the number that was... shared by our testifier, Mr. Samuelson, perhaps Mr. McCormick might also have some ideas of cost.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, we haven't re-estimated our costs, and I didn't bring the spreadsheet that I have. It's, I think it may be, I'm trying to think, is it, okay. So we had one-time cost of $12 million, and we had ongoing costs of about $19 million. So we're looking at around a $31.4 million. If it was implemented the way the rules were written, the first round of rules, that was when we did this. We did this quite a long time ago, and we haven't really touched the issue at all, so I really couldn't respond as to how accurate it is right now. They have made some changes in implementation that may affect it, but that's what our last estimate was.
Ongoing means for how long?
Representative Erdahl.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, I think we were looking at ongoing costs for implementing it at least through the first, it may have been through 2017, I think, because you do have to, there's a way the regulation allows you to first work with younger driver license holders and then work with older driver license holders in the second phase. The younger driver license holders are thought to be more at risk than the older driver license holders in terms of security risks. And so that was how they set the bill up. So there was like 4 years to implement with younger drivers and 4 with older drivers.
Last question, Representative.
Last question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, in other words, we have to cut another $31 million out of our budget to do this.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, I think the I wouldn't say we have to right now because we're not able to do anything with Real ID right now. But if we were going to implement it, it would probably result in costs somewhere in that ballpark.
Thank you, members. So, I'd like to bring this to a vote. Do you have any final comments, Representative?
Just very briefly. Obviously, there are a number of issues here at stake, and we talked a little bit about how we travel, you know, what the possible consequences from the federal government. What we're being asked here is to strike a balance. I mean, there are other issues that are quite important to Representative Erdahl, for instance, like, you know, does he want someone in Louisiana to have access, you know, to vital privacy information by virtue of having all that information dumped into one big database. That's not necessarily the purview of this committee. I think Representative Holbrook is right that there's a civil law focus on that. I understand that what I'm asking you to do is basically to call a federal government bluff, join 11 other states to do that. I think it is absolutely incumbent on the federal government to work with states to better our driver license issuances and processes. I seriously question whether or not it's appropriate for the federal government to create a de facto ID card. I want the rights reserved to the state relative to driver's licenses to stay. I should say, I think it's an appropriate question for this committee. We appreciate your support.
Thank you very much, and just a personal thank you to Representative Mariani for championing this over the years. We worked closely last year when it was on the omnibus bill, which caused a lot of interesting issues towards the end of session last year. So, members, with that, I will renew my motion to have House File 988 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Public Safety Policy Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank
you.
Mr. Chairman.
And you can stay where you are, Representative Mariani, because we've got a doubleheader coming up here.
It's painful for me, Mr. Chair. I was struggling.
Yeah.
USA versus Puerto Rico last night.
Right. What was the final on that?
The United States pulled out a one-run victory in the ninth inning with one out.
Oh, wow.
Bottom
okay.
of ninth inning. Great game.
Yeah. My son was watching it. Love it. So we now have the second part of the Representative Mariani doubleheader, the House File 1190. And if you'd like to Before you present your bill, Representative Mariani, I will move that House File 1190 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the State and Local Government Operations Committee. We have some state procurement provisions in this bill, and so Representative Pawlowski would need to see it. So welcome back, and we'll take House File 1190, Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, and members, House File 1190 is, I guess, an unusual bill, but I think it's an important bill, particularly in the times that we're in. Basically, it's actually pretty simple. Basically, what we're proposing is to have the state play an important role, and perhaps at this point, perhaps the only entity that could play a role, given the times that we're in, to promote a new market relative to electric vehicle production and usage in our society. It's not unusual historically to have governments play those roles in terms of making early catalytic kind of investments and encouragement to get new economies, new processes triggered into our society. What we're trying to do here is to meet a couple of very important objectives for our society. One is to meet our new standards of environmental protection needs relative to the use of non-electric vehicles, in other words, the whole kind of culture, if you will, in terms of the impact that has on our environment. And then, as I said, also to stimulate the production of these vehicles, but also there is actually a very unique, almost Minnesota role here to both protect and stimulate job growth in Minnesota. Many of you know that we have one of the few pickup truck assembly plants in the nation, certainly up in the upper Midwest. I think we're pretty unique in that regard. The St. Paul Ford auto plant is a vital component of our regional economy, employing hundreds, if not thousands, but hundreds of, I think at one time thousands, but certainly hundreds of well-paying jobs here in the region, and then obviously also fueling vendor contracts throughout the region. What this bill would do is it would require state entities and certain municipalities to ensure that at least 25% of passenger vehicle purchases that they make, our governmental units do in fact make those purchases in order to carry out their work, at least 25% of those be electric vehicles. And then for such vehicles that are pickup trucks, that they must be made in Minnesota. There are some exceptions made to that requirement based on whether such a vehicle is available and also subject to whether or not there's a cost-benefit deficit. In other words, if you attempt to buy a similar vehicle at a lower price, you know, then we would have the question that you should, in fact, buy the lower price carbon polluting vehicle because of the importance of making sure that we're not you know, driving costs to state government and local government costs. Remember, that's really basically it. There are some issues that this certainly raises. This is new stuff in many ways for us. We'll hear about some of the concerns in regards to that, but at this point I would turn to my testifiers to explain the concept of Fuller and how they came about and what they believe is at stake here, and also why they think this is both a good idea but also a very doable and necessary idea for our state.
And thank you, Representative Mariani, and just to let you know and your testifiers, we had a pretty good discussion a week ago related to a similar bill on electric car infrastructure, so we've kind of vetted some of those issues. So, members, I would like to just focus on some of the provisions in this bill around purchasing and the Ford plant. So, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Chair, Jim Reinitz, I'm the executive director of the Auto Workers of Minnesota. We're a newly formed nonprofit. We have a board of directors made up of both Minnesota business and labor leaders. We formed 2 years ago to help build up the automobile manufacturing industry with beneficial to Minnesota. Over the last 2 years, we've engaged Minnesotans that have inventions that could help the automobile industry create new green jobs in Minnesota. 2 years ago, we met Bob Albertson at Representative Tori Weston's office. Bob Albertson was introduced to us as an inventor who had over 200 patents in his name. Some of his inventions include the weed eater, the coffee vending machine, the pulsating power head, and the electronic trolling motor. Bob indicated to us that he could make a total electric Ford Ranger. The Auto Workers of Minnesota provided the Ford Ranger and allowed Bob to put his invention into action. The electric Ford Ranger that he has provided us is totally electric. It can be charged up with a regular 110 volt outlet. It can go 170 miles at 75 miles per hour on one charge. It can tow two snowmobiles on a trailer for 170 miles at 75 miles per hour on one charge. It has heat and air conditioning. The bed of the truck will be usable and will be able to haul the same poundage as its gas counterpart. The truck can be a four-wheel drive. The truck is fully charged in 8 hours. After the truck is charged 20 minutes, it can run 50 miles. If the truck doesn't start, the only place that people have to look is really the main battery cable connection to the main battery. The magnet drive Bob's invention is based on magnets. When the electric engine is turned on, the magnet at one end starts spinning. As you press the acceleration pedal, the drive with the other magnet gets closer. And as the spinning magnet and the magnet on the axle drive get closer and closer together, the drive speed increases. The magnet drive needs no transmission oil. The magnet drive will never need to be opened and repaired. The magnet drive will never be over-torqued. Magnets will self-correct themselves. The Tesla Motors electric vehicle has a problem of the drive becoming over-torqued and breaking. The magnets on the drive and the electric motor have a lifetime warranty. The cost of the vehicle will be around $22,000. It costs Bob around $38 a month to run the batteries all the way down and then to charge them overnight. I was trying to how to compare our electric ranges with a fleet vehicle that is owned by the state or local government. There'd be many variables to take into account for, like the fuel rate, the cost of electricity for the different governments and different uses for the fleet vehicle. So I decided to compare the electric ranger to a gasoline-powered ranger. I assume the gas-powered ranger has about 20 miles per gallon. The gasoline cost will be about $2 per gallon, with the vehicle putting about 500 miles a week in traveling. The gasoline-powered engine would take about $50 a week in gas, and the electric ranger charged for 5 days would cost around $6.15 for the week. These figures don't include the oil changes that the gas ranger needs. If the gas ranger needs oil change every 3,000 miles, assuming there's 8 oil changes a year would cost around $30 a change, that's another $240 additional cost per year for the gas ranger. We were fortunate to have the electric ranger displayed at the Minnesota State Fair this year. Many people stopped by to have a look. Even Carol Levin had a feature on us. We found our fellow Minnesotans were willing to buy our electric ranger if they were ready for sale. Many Christmas people commented on how this truck could cut their costs. Someone even mentioned that it could be a great pizza delivery truck. Some of our most ardent supporters of producing this truck and moving into the green economy are my fellow workers at the Twin Cities Ford Assembly Plant. With a packed union hall, they voted unanimously for a resolution supporting this bill that you're hearing today. They know that this truck can be assembled as an engineless rancher at the assembly plant and then converted over to electric vehicle. An engineless rancher was made up the Edison, New Jersey forest plant. These assembly plant workers had the knowledge and the willingness to work for Ford or to whomever to get this product made. Even though with the tough economic times, the layoffs, the potential closing of the plant, they have shown a dedication to Ford. They have impressed Detroit. That plant continues to win J.D. Power Awards for quality, to be the top assembly plant for the fastest produced vehicles in its class. They even won the Ford North American President's Award for quality for 2008. I have even heard that those Twin Cities plant is one, if not the only plant that's making a profit for Ford. During this time when the auto industry is in trouble, and seems not to be delivering the product that most people want, people are turning to Washington, D.C. and Detroit for solutions. We believe some of those solutions in our midst, and we need to turn to those in an effort to encourage the industry along. We intend with the electric printer that Ford will make a profit, that the Twin Cities assembly plant will at a minimum reduce the number of layoff weeks, and at minimum maintain the employee role at the assembly plant, and we will create more new green economy jobs that will be involved in the conversion of the Ford ranchers. I would encourage you to help us create the green economy jobs by passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have already two members. Why don't we finish the public testimony, and then we can get into our discussion. I think we have one more person that wants to testify. Is that correct, Representative Mariani?
I believe that's so.
Oh, okay. Yes. All right. Well, then why don't we start with Representative Swales. I have Representative Erdahl and Portman. Oh.
Okay?
Right. I'll ask actually maybe at this point if there's anyone that wants to testify in opposition to this bill. Okay. Well, then let's have Representative Swales, Erdahl, Portman, and Davids on my list. And then, again, I'd like to bring it to a vote shortly after that. So, Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am very, very happy to see one of my constituents sitting there, Mr. Colleen. It's very nice to see you. As I was out door knocking this last summer, I realized that we have an awful lot of United Auto Workers living in my community. And to a person, when I would meet them, they were talking about the Ford plant. And my question is, what is the relationship between Detroit and what's going on with the headquarters at Ford, where we've given them so much bailout money and everything? What is the genesis of being able to maybe attach yourself to some company program, corporate program? Is there an incentive that you're going after through the Ford Corporation? Do you have what is the relationship there?
Mr. Colleen.
I'm Bob Colleen. I'm the retired Secretary Treasurer for the United Auto Workers at Ford. With the Ford Motor Company, the Ford has not taken any loan money yet from the federal government. They mortgaged all their properties and leveraged everything they had, and they're still losing money, but they're still viable, and they don't foresee taking any loan money from the federal government. My understanding is the authors of the bill have contacted Ford about producing this vehicle. That answer, they received some sort of an answer from Ford. As far as the viability of the program, Ford would not be involved in the conversion to electric. They would just produce the vehicle without the gasoline components, the mufflers, the air movement equipment, the radiator, things like that. So.
All right. Well, as a follow-up then, how many jobs are we talking about that would be maintained at the Ford plant?
The current roles at Ford are about 800 workers right now. In 2006, when Ford made their decision to shutter the plant, we were up around 2,000 workers, probably around 2,200 with salary and hourly.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Queen. you were touching on one of my questions, and that is what do you think the level of interest of the Ford Motor Company would be in the project that you've been outlining?
My understanding of the Ford Motor Company in this project goes back to the late 90s and early 2000s when Ford produced an electric vehicle and they did all the work out of their Edison assembly plant. This program was implemented out in California. It was an electric vehicle that they were using out there, and everything was working good on it, and then for whatever reason the electric vehicle was killed. All three manufacturers were involved in it. Not Toyota, but Honda was involved in it, and Honda was actually doing a pretty good job of it too, and all four manufacturers just quit building it. As of now, our goal is to get Ford interested in the program. We had this thing at the state fair, and the interest is just unbelievable. We had people lined up for the 7 days of the fair. We had it out there. We may have to drag Ford Motor Company kicking and screaming to the trough, but we're not willing to give up on the job to do that.
That's never at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is a good thing. I actually talked about it last late summer with Senator Coleman, and talked about that. I thought, why not convert the Ford plant to electric? And his comment was that he had other plans. That was right before the announcement was made that he would continue for a while longer. He was in the middle of those negotiations. But his concern, and I guess the concern of many of us, should be if Ford were to transition to this, why would they do it in Minnesota? Why would they not maybe pick a state in the South where they felt that they had more favorable tax climate to do this? So that's one of my concerns. I'd like to see it happen in Minnesota. I'd like to see what you're doing come to fruition. But I'm wondering if we may have to do some other things to entice Ford to do that.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I think that goes to the heart of the issue in terms of the uniqueness of this bill. I'm glad you asked it. Obviously we have an incredible facility here in the upper Midwest that, leads in industry standards in terms of efficiency, effectiveness, the training of the individuals, the product that they produce is a high-quality product. It would be, first and foremost, an incredible change for us to lose that kind of manufacturing, major manufacturing sector in our state. And so that's, obviously part of what's driving this. Our belief is that it's not lost on the parent company, that in fact it has this incredible capacity here. I think the issue here is that the novelness of this approach really speaks to whether or not we can establish a market, a strong and effective market here. We believe we can. We believe we can because we know we can produce efficiently a good product. We have the technology. Now to develop a new type of product that meets lots of the concerns that Minnesotans have about both quality but also protecting the environment. And so therefore, Mr. Reinert's testimony of their interaction with Minnesota fairgoers, the response that they were giving them back, is some level of reassurance and confirmation of that. So the issue really goes, I think, to whether or not we can, in fact, develop to some degree, I suppose, a guaranteed market share, at least to get us going, so that eventually the broader marketplace dynamics that are not dependent on government expenditure decisions, can drive this issue. I am not surprised by the hesitancy of the Ford Motor Company or any other automobile company, but I leave it to you to judge, whether or not they have been, quite frankly, visionary enough to be able to produce the kind of products that Minnesotans want and that we need. So I think there is a bit of kicking and screaming, but I think in the end we're going to be winners all the way around, including this particular company.
Thank you. Let's get to Representative Portman, Representative Davids, and then hopefully get to a vote. Oh, Representative Leader, and then we'll do a vote. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the UAW members here, I really appreciate the resolution that your local voted on in support of your measure that you have here today, and I just want to let you know I got added as a co-author for the bill, and I think it's a fantastic idea. And it'll come as no surprise to anyone in this room that I think Detroit needs a nudge to start moving in the right direction to give consumers what they want. And if we're serious about saving the jobs that are left at the Ford plant, we need to nudge the industry to make the cars that the middle class can buy and then can afford to operate. And just for the point of information for the members of the committee, how something like this interplays with the clean car standards that we heard is that there is zero carbon dioxide and pollution coming from the tailpipe of this vehicle. So for every vehicle like this that Ford sold, they could sell basically a tank to average out to a moderate level of carbon dioxide pollution. And so the clean car standards would also incentivize production of the electric Ford Ranger in Minnesota. I think we should do Representative Mariani still, and I think we should do mine.
What about Representative Hornstein's electric car?
And that one too.
Okay.
That order.
Okay. Representative Davids and then Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may have to support this bill because if we have enough electric cars, then I think Representative Horvath referred to a tank. I said that's code word for my E85 Suburban. I'm just sure of it. But that being said, two questions. One is on page 2, lines 2.3. Representative Mariani, what would your intent be on what it means to have a similar cost comparable to or comparable vehicle? Similar cost to a comparable. What's similar? Are we talking 10%, 15%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, that's a good question. I don't have a technical answer to that. I suspect that there are standards that are established under the notion of similar costs. I would certainly be willing to be much more clear and prescriptive about what that would be. The intent, quite simply, was that not to burden any of our governmental units with having to spend great sums over and above what they're currently spending out in the marketplace. And then further go on to talk about, doesn't answer your question directly, but talk about some of the factors that need to be considered in that similar cost standard to include both maintenance and operations and repair and fuel costs of the vehicle. But I'm certainly open to being much more prescriptive and clear about what that would be.
Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Then on page 1, line 1.22, it's the state will be mandating a full-size pickup, a Ford Ranger, and there, I don't believe there's any full-size pickups manufactured in Minnesota, and I do not believe that a Ford Ranger is a full-size pickup.
In the terms of the big three, I guess the full-size pickup truck would be an F-Series in Ford's world. A Ranger is a mid-size pickup truck.
I'm all for saving jobs at the Ford plant, but if we're going to be making electric Rangers, the bill says if we're mandated to buy full-size pickups made in Minnesota, so why are we making Rangers?
Representative Davids, maybe Mr. Burris could clarify some of this language about definitions. Good questions, Representative Davids. Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, full-size pickups is a statutory term that actually refers to pickups that are 1 ton or less, so it includes smaller pickups.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. So if there's no one else, I want to just round out the discussion with Chairman Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I certainly support the concept of all of this, but I think we've got a couple issues here. One thing has been not customary, I think statutorily, that you don't design legislation around one product. I know when you bid and you call for bids, any governmental entity can't write a spec around one product. And pretty much we got that here. And certainly I'm supporting all this. I support electric vehicles, but we got some real problems. The other thing is I don't know how long it's my understanding when you set up the new model, you don't retool and put it in a year. You got a 2012 mandate here, and a 2010, it's never been in productivity. I don't think you could bring it online that quickly, and you got a mandate by 2012. There are a couple other issues in there. I think the concept and everything is good, but I've got a real concern from the power of taking the authorities, and you're actually spending taxpayers' money and mandating 25%. We don't even know if it's going to be available at that time. I think there's some real problems here that have to be worked out, especially we haven't had any testimony by any local units of the state.
So, and that's a good maybe transition to our next task, which is to vote on this and send it to the, I believe, appropriate committee to address all of those issues, which is state and local government operations. Well, no, actually, it's a different, that's the sun. I went into Senatees, unfortunately. Please don't hold that against me. It is called that. Okay, state and local government operations. That would be the committee, I think, that would really need to look carefully at the mandate question that Representative Leader brings up, as well as procurement. There is a precedent for this. We did a plug-in hybrid bill that a couple of years ago that had some procurement language, and we might be able to adapt that. Because I think it did meet in part some of Representative Leader's concerns. Members, is there any more discussion? Otherwise, I'll ask Representative Mariani to maybe make some brief concluding comments, and then we'll vote on the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I won't delay. I know you have other bills. As evidenced by my response to Mr. Davis, it is this author's total willingness to continue to shape these concepts. Representative Leader has raised some important issues I think you do need to struggle with. I just simply want to reiterate that we are in incredibly unique times, and I think incredibly unique times requires unique action, including unique action on the part of this legislature. Whatever it takes to be able to make sure that we're acting wisely and prudently in terms of shaping this concept as we go forward, I am more than open to continue to do that. I would ask that you keep this idea alive and keep us moving forward so we can do that. I appreciate the time and the consideration.
And with that, I will renew my motion to have House File 1190 be passed and re-referred to the State and Local Government Operations, etc. Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, and thank you very much to our testifiers and to Representative Mariani. As we are preparing for House File 912, I'd like to have Representative Mason move our minutes from our last meeting.
So moved.
Representative Mason moves that we adopt the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. And this is also maybe a good opportunity to remind those in the public to please turn off all of your cell phones and other portable electronic devices for the duration of our hearing. And we have House File 912 before us, and it's my hope that we'll get this bill addressed today. And we have one more bill after that. We'll just have to see how this goes. So, okay. Representative Eakin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I would like to have House File 912 moved for consideration. And I believe it would be referred to the General Register.
Okay. Are there, if there's no fiscal impact, then that would probably be the motion here. So thank you.
Okay. Great. And I also have an amendment that I would also like to move to get it in the shape and form that I would like. That would be the A1 amendment.
Okay, members, let's, is everyone, do you want to explain the amendment or?
Sure. Sure. This amendment, actually it was language that was brought forward through negotiation with the Township Association, and what this does is it says to the extent practicable, cargo tank vehicles that are exempt shall complete deliveries by 12 p.m. And actually, I have an oral amendment I'd like to make to this. It says by 12 p.m. and before the last week of April. This I would like to change to April 15th. To if I could just have an oral amendment moved on line 1.7 of the A1 amendment.
Yeah,
that would strike.
Okay, go ahead.
That would strike the words "the last week of" and after April, insert 15.
Mr. Chair. I'll move that.
Okay.
I'd like to win one.
Representative Berdahl moves the oral amendment, which I will ask Mr. Burris to repeat.
Mr. Chair, members, the oral amendment is to amend the H0912A1 amendment on page 1, line 7, delete the last week of. And after April, insert 15.
Okay. And members, we didn't adopt the A1 amendment yet, so we'll incorporate this into the A1 amendment.
Okay, great.
Are there any questions about either the written A1 amendment or the oral amendment that we're incorporating into that? Representative Erdahl, do you want to move the whole package?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move the whole package.
And this, members, this is really simply to get the bill into the shape that the author would like us to discuss it. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, and the motion prevails. So we have before us the amended House File 912. Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And again, the amendment that was just added does make the language more amenable to the township to have taken a neutral position on it, actually. That's partly due to the concerns about safety and delivering fuel oil and propane to those who need it during the spring months when there are restrictions in place. And this would provide an exemption to those restrictions for those who do deliver the propane and the fuel oil to make sure the people get the assistance that they need in heat during those months. And there are a number of exemptions that are already in law. This just simply adds one more to that list for this purpose. And again, I think that it is a public safety issue. And as far as the exemptions are concerned, some of the others that have exemptions utilize the roads much more often than those who are providing fuel, heating fuel and propane. It's usually just once during that season that this is done. So anyway, I do have with me today two others to testify and to answer questions. Mr. Roger Leiter, as opposed to Leiter, pronounced Leiter, from the Propane Gas Association, and Mr. Bob Krogman from the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. So.
Chair and committee, I'm Roger Leiter with the Minnesota Propane Gas Association. And we're asking that you move forward on this limited exemption of spring weight restrictions. One of the basic reasons we're looking forward to this is that the most common delivery vehicle used by the propane industry in rural Minnesota for delivering to homes and farms is overweight empty on a 5-ton restricted road. Minnesota propane dealers right now serve over 250,000 homes, farms, and industries in rural Minnesota with the needed fuel. Approximately 75% of those will need a single delivery, sometime during that spring weight restriction time period. On average, 16 to 20% of all the heating degree days happen from March 15th to May 15th. And with that, we are going to need to make deliveries to people to keep them in fuel. Our people want to do this the most expeditious way, with a limited amount of damage to roads, and to keep our customers and your constituents in fuel. propane and fuel oil dealers average, you know, less than one delivery per customer, but you know, customers will receive most likely never more than one delivery during this time period. So we think it has limited impact, and we're asking for your help in moving this forward.
Yes, welcome. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, we'll move on then to the representative from the Petroleum Marketers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our members deliver heating oil, and our trucks, too, are overweight or nearly overweight, empty. And without an exemption, we could not legally make deliveries during the spring restriction. The amendment and the bill are written such that the exemption would apply to only half full on seasonally restricted roads. Requiring the forward two compartments to be used moves the weight forward in it, so we would fall within the 2-ton exemption granted the other folks in the statute. So we're looking at any possible way to continue to deliver the necessary fuel during the spring restriction. And again, it'd be one trip a season. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any... we have one more, I believe. Is there... No? Okay. All right. Are there any more people that would like to testify in favor of the House file?
Mr. Chairman, Bruce Clavin. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Cooperatives, now known as Cooperative Network. My testimony is simple. It's simply me, too. We support the bill. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Houseman.
Mr. Chair, just out of curiosity, does the relevant State Department have a position on the bill?
Well, Representative Eakin.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Houseman, I do know that the Department of Transportation is officially neutral on this legislation. I don't know okay. about
well,
anyone to testify.
Representative Houseman, we have a panel of opponents, so they will. I guess I'd like to call on them if we have no additional testimony in support of the bill. I believe we have Mr. O'Connor, Mr. Vanasek, and Mr. Pettis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, good afternoon. My name is Ryan O'Connor. I'm the Transportation Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. And today I would like to briefly address the Association of Minnesota Counties' general interest in weight limit exemptions before ceding to Mr. Darrell Pettis, LeSueur County Engineer and Vice President of the Minnesota County Engineers Association, who will bring additional technical points of note into this discussion. In December of 2008, the Association of Minnesota Counties adopted a policy position regarding weight limits that states, AMC supports the prohibition of any weight limit exemptions except during harvest. The rationale supporting this policy position was based on three major principles. First, uniformity. The completion of past statewide weight studies and an examination of the current seasonal load restriction statute is 169.87. demonstrates that weight limit exemptions are already granted to four types of vehicles, and I believe Mr. Pettis will specify those four types. Unless a consistent uniform weight limit policy finds legislative support, AMC is concerned that additional vehicle types will continue seeking weight limit exemptions under the rationale that they provide a service to the public that cannot be interrupted due to a change in season. The second principle upon which this policy position was adapted is that the ability already exists to obtain overweight permits. Entities that are able to demonstrate exigency can apply for overweight permits through local units of government already. These permits suspend the weight limit restrictions on a case-by-case basis. While obtaining an overweight permit can admittedly be tedious if a truck must travel across multiple local jurisdictions, current statute allows for the necessary emergency exemptions while also providing an incentive to propane deliverers to educate their consumers about the need to plan for the chance of cold weather during those spring months. And finally, increased road maintenance needs was also considered when adopting this policy position. Spring weight limits obviously exist for a reason, and any additional weight limit exemptions will surely stress to local roads during their most vulnerable time of the year. While one additional overweight truck might not seem like a significant amount of stress for a local road, the fact is that one such vehicle can provide the stress equivalent to thousands of light-duty vehicles on that road. The funds to repair these stressed roads thereupon are siphoned from limited resources from other road projects in your jurisdiction, making it even more difficult to maintain the status quo on your transportation infrastructure. At this point, I would like to turn the microphone over to Mr. Pettis for additional analysis, and I would, of course, be happy to answer any questions that you may have in a moment. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Pettis.
Thank you, Chairperson Hornstein and committee members. As stated before, my name is Darrell Pettis, and I currently serve as the Le Sueur County Highway Engineer and the Vice President of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. I'm here today to speak on the County Engineers Association behalf. In January, our association approved the following policy statement. The Minnesota County Engineers Association opposes enacting legislation that provides exemptions to local road and bridge postings. House File 912 proposes to add exemptions to current truck weight laws. Therefore, I am testifying in opposition to this bill. House File 912 proposes to add cargo tank vehicles for liquid fuels and propane to existing lists of vehicles that are either exempt or partially exempt from spring load restrictions. The vehicles already listed in statute are school and Head Start buses, vehicles transporting milk, public utility vehicles for emergency work, recycling, and garbage vehicles. All of the existing exempt vehicles do include a maximum axle weight. House File 912 does not include a maximum per axle weight, just a limitation that no vehicle may be loaded at 50% capacity of the cargo tank. As a county engineer, I'm not very familiar with the operation and loading of cargo tank vehicles, so I call our local fuel supplier to see how they operate their fuel trucks. They operate two liquid fuel trucks, a 4,500-gallon truck and a 4,000-gallon truck. Both are three axles. Loaded with fuel, they weigh approximately 48,000 pounds and 53,000 pounds at full capacity, and they are legal on both a 9 and a 10-ton per axle road. Applying the up to 50% capacity as stated in the bill, both vehicles would be legal on a 7-ton per axle roadway. However, they both would be overloaded on a 5-ton per axle route. The three-axle truck that they use to haul propane is a 5,000-gallon tank, which loaded at 80% capacity, which is a full load, also weighs about 52,000 pounds. It is also legal on both 9 and 10 tons per axle roadways. Applying the up to 50% of capacity as stated in the bill, the propane truck would be overloaded on both 7 and 5 ton per axle roadways. So what does that mean to the road system? The traditional relationship between pavement damage and the applied axle load is that damage increases to the fourth power as axle load increases. Therefore, a 7 ton per axle load causes 3.8 times as much damage as a 5 ton per axle load. And a 9-ton per axle load causes 10.5 times the damage of the 5-ton per axle load. In other words, one 9-ton per axle load does more road damage than 10 5-ton per axle loads. Almost all the paved roads in Le Sueur County are seasonally road posted at 7 tons or greater. However, there are a few miles of county paved road and, in fact, 18 miles of trunk highways that are seasonally load restricted to 5 tons per axle. In fact, MnDOT has more 5-ton per axle pavements in Le Sueur County than the county does. The vast majority of the 5-ton per axle seasonal load restriction roads in the state, as in Le Sueur County, are gravel roads. Using Le Sueur County's example, we have about 200 miles of county gravel road. These roads rely almost entirely on the property tax for maintenance and repair. This system is most at risk when county program aids are reduced and levy limits are imposed, both of which happened in the past year. With that, I would like to end my testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Vanosik, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Bob Vanosik, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Inter-County Association. I'll just add two quick points. One is, I believe it's been distributed a section of the 2008 Omnibus Transportation Policy Bill that you enacted last year, and that section states that it's the intent of the legislature to look at the issue of overweight vehicles during the 2010 session. Seems to me if that is your intention, that you probably shouldn't be passing legislation this year in advance of looking at the issue to grant additional weight exemptions. The second point is is Mr. O'Connor already alluded to the ability to call a county engineer, township official, to get a waiver if you've got a case where a residence is running out of heating oil or propane. That may be inconvenient for the hauler to do, to make that one or a few phone calls, but I guess we would submit that that inconvenience is trumped by the need to protect the taxpayers' investments in our roads. I also understand that there's a second avenue of relief, and that is if you have an unseasonably cold spring, they can petition the governor for a blanket waiver, and that is something that has been done in the past, and I believe it's also been done this year. So again, I would say if that's the case, you really don't need, there's no urgency to pass this legislation until you've had an opportunity to study the overall issue of weight exemption. Thank you.
Okay. Members, are there any questions of the opponents? Okay. I would try to get the author's thoughts on this. Having heard the testimony today, I'm a little reticent to send this bill directly to the floor out of this committee. One option would be to see, and I have that concern because I was very involved in some of the negotiations and conversations we had around the Omnibus Transportation Policy Bill in 07, where we did pass Section 115, which Mr. Vanosik alluded to. You know, one option, Representative Eakin, might be to see if there's any room for conversation, discussion, or compromise with the public sector entities that testified today. Otherwise, this wouldn't even be in effect for this spring anyway. Is that your understanding, Representative Eakin?
I believe that would be correct, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krogan?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the bill would not be in effect. Last week, the governor granted an exemption for seasonally weight-restricted roads for this season with the language from the bill, half full, with that language. So in this year, the governor's exemption is in place.
Well, if that's the case, and thank you for that information. You know, we could lay this bill over and have this perhaps part of the broader conversation that I know we're going to have in 2010 about truck weights, especially if it has no effect this season. And then this could be part of, I think, a broader discussion that, again, it is the legislature's intention to have in 2010. And then, Representative Eakin, your bill would still be in this committee and alive. And, you know, I would think it could be part of that conversation, because what we would be doing here is, you know, passing a law permanently and potentially preempting that important discussion that has to take place next year. So, again, I think without any practical effect this year, process-wise, I think that would be, I think, the best thing we could do. If that's okay, Representative Eakin.
That would be acceptable to me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And so with that, members, I will just lay over House File 912. It's still in our committee, and this is probably not the end of the discussion. Okay. We have one more bill, members, if you can hang in there. We've already heard the testimony on it. It's House File 571. And Representative Taylor, I know you have made some updates to this since we last met a week ago. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to return with the amendment, which was not ready when you heard the testimony earlier. I would just like to, if someone would like to move my amendment.
Okay, I will move it. Representative Saylor, it's the A2, I believe. No, the A2?
Yes.
Okay.
And what this amendment does is make some significant modifications to the bill. It takes out Section 1 and Section 2, and also on page 2 it deletes Section 5. And what that does is that removes any reference to Section Minnesota Statute 84.798, which refers to ATVs, because it was always the intent, my intent, to not allow any extra ATVs on the roads, nor to allow these vehicles to go on ATV trails. This is simply to keep these trucks, which I'll refer you to this tiny little picture which you already have from last time, those trucks, to be on highways. And also a couple of other minor changes on page 3, line 23, delete the first comma and insert a semicolon. On page 5, line 4, after on, at first on, insert an interstate highway or on, and then it just includes the interstate highway, keeping them off of those highways as well.
Okay. Representative Taylor, what we'll do is, again, incorporate that into the your A2 amendment, but I would like to have Mr. Burris read the proposed oral amendment to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, that actually was part of the that's part of the
issue. Oh, that is. Okay. All right. Sorry about that.
Okay. And then the rest simply is about renumbering the sequence. So that is the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, let's incorporate that. It's an amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Sale issued the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As we heard from my constituents that came down last week to testify, it's the intent of this bill to allow these fuel-efficient small trucks to be able to be used by farmers and small businesses, which is predominantly, you know, who uses these vehicles, to allow them to make those trips to town to pick up extra supplies or deliver things without constantly stopping for little visits with the local sheriff. So at any rate, that's kind of what stimulated the bill in the first place, because currently they're not allowed to go on the roads, and this bill will allow them to do that. So I know that you heard most, you know, the testimony before. I don't know if you have any further questions or not, but the amendment that was adopted today, as I said, does take out any reference to the ATV issue, which makes it okay with the DNR. I worked with them intensely on this last week.
And Representative Taylor, I was remiss to actually then, after we amended your bill, to actually move it. So the motion before the committee is that House File 571 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Transportation Finance Division. There will be a fiscal note which is not ready yet, and so that's what we'll debate in Representative Leader's Committee if it does move. So, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wondering if the State Patrol had any opinions on this.
They are here, and I would like to have their testimony on the record. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Michelle Tuckner for the State Patrol. Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, I appreciate your time, members, a few moments to speak to this bill. We, Representative Taylor and I, did get a chance to speak briefly after the last informational hearing that we had on this bill. We do have a number of issues with the bill. It's primarily focused on the safety issues. The manufacturers import these vehicles as off-road vehicles. They do that to limit their liability. They do that because they don't meet federal safety standards. They don't meet federal emission standards, and our concern is that we're putting vehicles that are 2,200 pounds without the safety standards necessary in place up on roadways, mixing it up with the heavier vehicles up there. Our preference is that we not put these vehicles on the roadways unless they're going to meet the federal safety standards. In addition, they don't have, they're not properly titled. I understand the bill addresses that, but I think Driver and Vehicle Services would have some issues with trying to properly register those vehicles. They don't have the appropriate digits for a VIN number, which would be problematic for, I think, insuring them, and if the vehicles are stolen, for us from an enforcement perspective of trying to research that stolen vehicle.
Hey, members, we there's another committee coming at 2:45, so I don't want to rush this. So we do have some options to lay it over to the next meeting, but if we do feel ready to vote, then we can vote as well. So are there any questions of the testifiers. We also have an opportunity to discuss this further in Representative Leaders Committee, but we do need to vote one way or the other today, whether to move it on or to or not. Representative Saylor, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do, briefly. I would just like folks to know that the companion to this actually has moved on to the floor of the Senate, and that has had another amendment to it, which, as I understand it, does meet with the approval of the State Patrol.
That's correct.
And I believe that the other amendment also meets with the approval of the Department of Vehicle Services.
I can't speak to them, but yes, I believe that's true.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's highly likely that we'll be looking at that amendment.
Okay. Well, that's extremely important information to have on the record, Representative Saylor. Mm-hmm. Representative Hortman, a question, and then we'll proceed to the vote. No. Okay. All right. Well, the motion before us is to have House File 571 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. So thank you very much, and we will see you again in Representative Leaders Committee. Members, very quickly, before we adjourn, I wanted to let you know that we have a meeting scheduled for Monday evening, March 23rd. And this features the Transportation All-Stars. We have Representative Holberg with a bill, Representative Morrow has a bill, Representative Houseman and Erdahl. And we have everyone's an All-Star in this team.
Yeah, I was wondering why.
Tuesday on the 24th, we have the committee time for the Transportation and Finance. We have 13 bills and probably more. So that would be the night to make sure that you've eaten and gotten enough sleep. That's the 24th. And then the 25th, we have four bills. And members, there have been a lot of questions about whether we're going to do an omnibus transportation policy bill this year. We're not laying over bills for that purpose, but I'm meeting with Senator Murphy on Friday, and I'll have an answer for you on Monday. And if we do an omnibus policy bill, it would be my intention that any bill that has been voted on and approved by this committee would potentially be a candidate for that bill, assuming it's passed other appropriate policy committees. So with that, we stand adjourned.